healthy life look like for you? How would it make you feel, and what would you be doing? It is difficult to look solely to anyone else's definition of healthfulness, particularly because we are all different people with varying needs, preferences, and schedules. Instead, figure out what makes you feel best. Decide what combination of healthy eating, exercise, and sleep is right for you, and stick to it. Like so many things, healthy habits are best established gradually. Instead of trying to force yourself to take an hour at the gym at 6 a.m., try instead to do 15 minutes. Or perhaps swap out with a class you really enjoy. Or go at a time that works better for your schedule. Make it easy for yourself to succeed. Prep your meals or keep water by your desk so you can sip it throughout the day. Gradually recondition yourself to prefer healthy habits, ones that actually work for your lifestyle. Being busy. Another very common way that people sabotage is by distracting themselves to the point of being completely phased out of their lives. People who are constantly busy are running from themselves. Nobody is busy unless they want to be busy. And you will know that because so many people with extremely hectic schedules would never describe themselves that way. This is because being busy is not a virtue. It only signals to others that you do not know how to manage your time or your tasks. Being busy communicates importance. It often makes you seem a little untouchable to others. It also overwhelms the body so that it can only focus on the tasks at hand. Being busy is the ultimate way to distract ourselves from what's really wrong. How to resolve this? If your schedule is unmanageable, you're never going to be as effective or productive as you could be. If this is the case, your first job has to be to streamline and prioritize your tasks in order of importance. Outsource whatever else you can, and then let go of the rest. If your issue is that you intentionally create chaos and busyness in your day when there is no need for it, you have to get comfortable with simplicity and routine. Start with writing down your top 5 tasks that need to be done each day, and then focus on doing those and only those. You might also need to confront the sense of protection that being busy gives you. Does it make you feel more important than others? Does it give you an excuse to say no to plans or to avoid some people? You need to find healthier and more productive ways to cope with these feelings, such as finding genuine self-confidence in what you do by creating something you're proud of, or getting better at calmly but clearly stating your boundaries and needs in relationships. Spending time with the wrong people. It's true that so much of our lives is shaped by the people we spend them with. And the company you keep is another common way that people self-sabotage. Certainly, you can think of some people in your life who stress you out, make you feel insecure, and yet keep you coming back for more. These relationships exist at the lighter end of the toxicity spectrum, but they are self-defeating nonetheless. If you find yourself preoccupied with a certain friendship or relationship that is making you feel almost addicted to the feeling of being less than or jealous of, you need to gradually phase out of it. You don't need to be mean, rude, or even cut anyone out of your life. You do, however, need to understand that the people you spend the most time with will shape your future irrevocably, and so you must choose them wisely. How to resolve this? Work on building a circle of people who support and inspire you, who have similar goals and enjoy spending time with you. You should leave a get-together feeling energized and inspired, not exhausted and angry. It takes time to find your group of friends, and you may not discover that all at once. It could start with offering to take someone you admire out for coffee, or reaching out to do something with a person with whom you'd like to reconnect. Slowly, but genuinely, rebuild your connections, and then foster and care for them as much as you can. Worrying about irrational fears and least likely circumstances. Another very common way that people sabotage without realizing is by preoccupying themselves with fears of worst-case possible scenarios. You're probably familiar with this, at least to some degree. You have a weird or highly unlikely thought that evokes a deep sense of dread, fear, and series of doomsday scenarios in your head. You then keep coming back to it to the point that it even controls some part of your life. Irrational fears, especially the kind that are least likely to become reality, are often what we project real fears onto. These irrational fears are safe because deep down we know they aren't going to happen. They are placeholders, a way for us to express the feeling we really have onto something we know isn't going to happen. When you find yourself in a fear cycle, constantly repeating some strange, random, or unimportant one-off circumstance or situation that has a very low probability of becoming reality, ask yourself if you have any feelings about something related that is actually valid. For example, if you get anxious about being a passenger in a car, consider if your fear is of moving forward or being out of control. Or if you're anxious about being fired from your job, the fear might really be the idea that you aren't worthy of another job or being humiliated by a higher up. How to resolve this? Instead of wasting all of your energy trying to control some worst-case scenario, consider what the message of the fear may be and what it is telling you that you need in your life. If the fear was an abstract metaphor, what would the meaning be? Is the abrupt loss of income a symbol of your desire for security? Is the fear of the future a symbol for not living fully right now? Is the anxiety about making decisions a symbol for knowing what you really want and being too afraid to choose it? At the core of the things we most fear is a message that we are trying to send ourselves about what we really care about. If we can identify what we want to protect, we can find healthier and more secure ways to do it. How to tell if you're in a self-sabotage cycle? Even if you can cognitively understand self-sabotaging behaviors, sometimes the most difficult shift is recognizing that we are engaging in them. In fact, sometimes the signs are so subtle they are barely recognizable, and often don't come to our attention until they become highly problematic or someone else points them out. Some of the most prominent symptoms of self-sabotage are as follows. You are more aware of what you don't want than what you do. You spend more of your time worrying, ruminating, and focusing on what you hope doesn't happen than you do imagining, strategizing, and planning for what you do. You spend more time trying to impress people who don't like you than you spend with people who love you for who you are. You are more focused on growing into the kind of person who evokes the envy of your supposed enemies rather than the kind of person who is beloved by their family and friends and prioritizes them no matter what. You're putting your head in the sand. You don't know basic facts about your life, like how much debt you have or what other people in your field are being paid for similar work. When you get into an argument, you run away until you forget, rather than talking about what's wrong and coming up with a solution. In other words, you are in denial, and so any hope of healing is futile. You care more about convincing other people you're okay than actually being okay. You'd rather post photos that make it look like you had a great time than being concerned about whether you actually had a good time. You put more effort toward trying to convince everyone you're doing well rather than being honest and connecting with people who could help or support you. Your main priority in life is to be liked, even if that comes at the expense of being happy. You think more about whether or not your actions will earn you the approval of people, who are people, by the way, rather than whether or not they will actually make you feel fulfilled and content with who you are. You're more afraid of your feelings than anything else. If you get to the point in life at which the scariest, most detrimental thing you face is the fear of whether or not you will be able to handle your own emotions, you are the one standing in your own way. Nothing else is. You're blindly chasing goals without asking yourself why you want those things. If you are doing everything you are supposed to be doing, and yet you feel empty and depressed at the end of the day, the issue is probably that you're not really doing what you want to be doing. You've just adopted someone else's script for happiness. You're treating your coping mechanisms as the problem. Instead of trying to incite war on yourself to overcome your overeating, spending, drinking, sexing, whatever it is you know you need to improve, ask yourself what emotional need that thing is filling. Until you do, you will battle it forever. You value your doubt more than your potential. Negativity bias makes us believe that bad things are more real than good, and unless we keep that inclination in check, it can leave us believing that everything we fear to be true is more real than the good things that are actually true. You are trying to care about everything. Your willpower is a limited resource. You only have so much in a day. Rather than using it to try to become good at everything, decide what matters most to you. Focus your attention on that and let everything else slip away. You are waiting for someone else to open a door, offer approval, or hand you the life you have been waiting for. We grow up with the illusion that success is what's handed to people who are most deserving, talented, or privileged. When we arrive, however, we realize it is constructed by those who find an intersection of their interests, passions, skills, and a market gap. Sprinkle on a little bit of persistence, and the only way to fail is to give up. You don't realize how far you've come. You are not the person you were 5 years ago. You evolve, as your self-image does, so make sure that it's an accurate one. Give yourself credit for everything you've overcome that you never thought you would, and everything you've built that you never thought you could. You've come so much farther than you think, and you're so much closer than you realize. Identifying your subconscious commitments. Part of the reason we often experience intense inner conflict or self-sabotage is because of something called a core commitments, which is essentially your primary objective or intention for your life. Your subconscious commitments are basically what you want more than anything else, and you often aren't even aware of them. You can identify your core commitments by looking at the things that you struggle with most and the things you are most driven by. If you can peel back the layers of your motivations toward each, you'll find a root cause. When you find the same root cause for everything, you've found a core commitment. People only seem irrational and unpredictable until you understand what they are fundamentally committed to. For example, if someone has a core commitment to feel free, they may find themselves sabotaging work opportunities in order to achieve that. If someone's core commitment is to feel wanted, they could find themselves in a series of relationships in which they have intense connections but refuse to make commitments, out of fear that the spark will fade. If someone's core commitment is to be in control of their lives, they might have irrational anxiety about things that represent a loss of control. If someone's core commitment is to be loved by others, they might pretend to be helpless in certain areas of life because if they don't need others, they might be left by them. But the most important thing to understand is that your core commitments are actually a cover-up for core needs. Your core need is the opposite of your core commitment. Your core need is also another way to identify your purpose. For example, if your subconscious core commitment is to be in control, your core need is trust. If your subconscious core commitment is to be needed, your core need is to know you are wanted. If your subconscious core commitment is to be loved by others, your need is self-love. The less that you feed your core need, the louder your core commitment symptoms will be. If you are a person who needs trust and is therefore committed to staying in control, the less that you believe you are supported, the more your negative coping mechanisms are going to flare up. Perhaps this could happen in the form of disruptive eating patterns, isolating yourself, or hyperfixation on physical appearance. If you are committed to freedom and therefore need a sense of autonomy, the less that you build a life on your own terms, the more you are going to sabotage opportunities and feel drained and exhausted when you should feel happy. The more you lean into fulfilling your core needs, the more your commitments symptoms will disappear. Once you understand what a person really wants, you will be able to explain the intricacies of their habits and behaviors. You will be able to predict, down to the detail, what they will do in any given situation. More importantly, once you start asking yourself what you really want, you'll be able to stop battling the symptoms and start addressing the only issue that has ever really existed in your life, which is living out of alignment with your core needs and therefore your core purpose. Confronting repressed emotions and taking action. There is a difference between understanding why we self-sabotage and the act of no longer self-sabotaging. This means that once we understand the root and purpose of the behavior, we adjust it, we adapt. Overcoming self-sabotage is not just a matter of understanding why you're holding yourself back. It is being able to take action in the direction that you want and need to, even if it is initially uncomfortable or triggering. This is a very important part of the process because you are essentially going to be confronting the exact emotions you have been trying to avoid. When you stop engaging in self-sabotaging behavior, repressed emotions that you weren't even aware of will start to come up, and you might feel even worse than you did before. The thing about overcoming self-sabotage is that we don't often need to be told what to do. We know what we want to do, and we know what we need to do. It is simply that we are being held back by our fear of feeling. To begin to unravel this emotional holding pattern, we can work through the following to find more ease and space and freedom while we change our lives. The most common emotions that arise while you're breaking self-sabotaging behaviors. The first feeling you are likely to confront is resistance. This is that generalized sense of being stuck, or your body feeling so tense that it is almost hard, as though you are hitting a wall. This feeling is usually masking emotion that is preventing you from actually being aware of the sensations beneath it, which are more acute. When you start to feel resistance, you don't want to just push through it. In fact, trying to do that means you'll keep hitting the same wall that you're up against already. You're going to strengthen the self-sabotaging behavior because you aren't really resolving the problem by just trying to override it. Instead, start asking the right questions. Why do I feel this way? What is this feeling trying to tell me about the action I am trying to take? Is there something I need to learn here? What do I need to do to honor my needs right now? Then you have to reconnect to your inspiration or your vision for life. Get clear on why you want to take this action and make a change. When your motivation is the fact that you want to live a different and better existence, you're going to find that a lot of the resistance fades because you're being pushed by a vision that's greater than your fear. In other cases, you might run into other emotions such as anger, sadness, or inadequacy. When those feelings come up, it is very important to make space for them. This means to allow them to rise up in your body and observe them. Watch where they make you tense up or constrict. Feel what they want you to feel. There is nothing worse than the fear of feeling the emotion, as the experience itself is ultimately often just some physical tension around which we've crafted a story. Remember that a lot of these feelings may very well have a root in something related to the self-sabotaging behavior. If you are angry about how one of your parents treated you, it probably won't come as a surprise that the core feeling of why you are sabotaging your relationships is anger and mistrust. The feelings associated with self-sabotage are not usually random. In fact, they can lead us to deeper insights about what we really need and what problems within us are still unresolved. To fully release those feelings, once you are aware of them, try writing yourself a letter. Write something to your younger self or from the perspective of your future self. Write down a mantra or a manifesto. Remind yourself that you love yourself too much to settle for less, or that it is okay to be angry in unfair or frustrating circumstances. Give yourself space to experience the depth of your emotions so that they do not control your behaviors. Disconnecting action and feeling. The final and most important lesson to overcome self-sabotage is to learn to disconnect action from feeling. We are not held back in life because we are incapable of making change. We are held back because we don't feel like making change, and so we don't. The truth is that you can have a vision of what you want, know that it is undoubtedly right for you, and simply not feel like taking the action required to pursue that path. This is because our feelings are essentially wired as comfort systems. They produce a good feeling when we are doing what we have always done, staying in familiarity. This, to our bodies, registers as safety. In other cases, the accomplishments or changes that we are very happy about are those that we also perceive to offer us a greater measure of safety. If the achievement potentially puts us at risk in any way, or exposes us to something unfamiliar, we aren't going to be happy about it initially, even if it is a net positive for our lives. However, we can actually train ourselves to prefer behaviors that are good for us. This is how we restructure our comfort zones. We begin to crave what we repeatedly do, but the first few times we do it, we often feel uncomfortable. The trick is being able to override that initial hesitation so we are guiding our lives with logic and reason, not emotionality. Though your emotions are always valid and need to be validated, they are hardly ever an accurate measure of what you are capable of in life. They are not always an accurate reflection of reality. All your feelings know is what you've done in the past, and they are attached to what they've drawn comfort from. You may feel as though you are worthless, but you most certainly are not. You may feel as though there is no hope, but there most certainly is. You may feel as though everyone dislikes you, but that is probably a gross over-exaggeration. You may think everyone is judging you, but that is a misperception. Most importantly, you may feel as though you cannot take action, when you most certainly can. You simply do not feel willing because you are not used to it. By using logic and vision to guide ourselves, we are able to identify a different and better life experience. When we imagine this, we feel peaceful and inspired. To rise up to meet this version of our lives, we must overcome our resistance and discomfort. We will not feel happy initially, no matter how right for us those actions are. It is essential that you learn to take action before you feel like doing it. Taking action builds momentum and creates motivation. These feelings will not come to you spontaneously. You have to generate them. You have to inspire yourself. You have to move. You have to simply begin and allow your life and your energy to reorient itself to prefer the behaviors that are going to move your life forward, not the ones that are keeping you held back. Chapter 3. Your triggers are the guides to your freedom. Now that you have begun to identify yourself sabotaging behaviors, you can use them to uncover deeper and more important truths about who you are as a person and what you really want and need out of life. This is an important part of the process because overcoming our self-defeating habits is not just about knowing what they are or why we engage in them. It is also about better understanding what our inherent needs are, what we really desire, and how we can use this as a pivot point to begin building a life that is aligned with who we really are and what we are here to do. Our triggers do not actually exist just to show us where we are storing unresolved pain. In fact, they show us something much deeper. Each negative emotion we experience comes with a message, one that we do not yet know how to interpret. This is when a single challenge begins to become a chronic issue. Unable to honor and use the guidance of the emotion, we shut the feeling down, store it in our bodies, and try to avoid anything that might bring it up again. This is when we become sensitive to the world around us, because there are a lot of repressed feelings mounting. On the surface, it seems as though the thing that triggers our emotional response is the problem. It is not. The problem is that we don't know what to do with how we feel, and therefore do not have all of the emotional processing skills that we need. When we can identify why something is triggering us, we can use the experience as a catalyst for a release and positive life change. How to interpret negative emotions. Though everyone's particular triggers are unique to them, it helps to better understand the function of some of the feelings that we often condemn. Some of the emotions that are most strongly connected with self-sabotaging behaviors are actually important for us to better understand. It is not about simply getting over them. It is about listening to what they are trying to tell us about our experience. Anger. Anger is a beautiful, transformative emotion. It is mischaracterized by its shadow side, aggression, and therefore we try to resist it. It is healthy to be angry, and anger can also show us important aspects of who we are and what we care about. For example, anger shows us where our boundaries are. Anger also helps us identify what we find to be unjust. Ultimately, anger is trying to mobilize us, to initiate action. Anger is transformative, and it is often the peak state we reach before we truly change our lives. This is because anger is not intended to be projected onto someone else. Rather, it's an influx of motivation that helps us change what we need to change within our lives. When we do not see it as such, we tend to bury it, not ever resolving the real issue at hand. This is when anger starts to cross over into aggression. When we take that energy out on those around us, as opposed to using it as an impetus to change ourselves. Instead of being afraid of anger, we can instead use it to help us see our limits and priorities more clearly. We can also use it to help us make big, important changes, both for ourselves and the world around us. Sadness. Sadness is the normal and correct response to the loss of something you very much love. This is an emotion that often comes up in the aftermath of a disappointment. This could be the loss of a relationship, a job, or just a general idea of what you thought your life would be. Sadness only becomes problematic when we do not allow ourselves to go through the natural phases of grief. Sadness does not release itself all at once. In fact, we often find that it happens in waves, some of which strike us at unexpected times. We do not ever need to feel embarrassed or wrong for needing to cry, feel down, or miss what we no longer have. In fact, crying at appropriate times is one of the biggest signs of mental strength, as people who are struggling often find it difficult to release their feelings and be vulnerable. Guilt. Guilt tends to affect us more for what we didn't do than what we did. In fact, people who struggle the most with guilt are the people who are not actually guilty of something terrible. People who commit heinous acts tend to not feel much remorse. The fact that you feel bad that you could have done wrong by someone is a good sign in itself. However, guilt requires us to look deeply at what behaviors, if any, we feel badly about, as well as what we may have done that was not in our best interest. If we have treated others unfairly, we must be able to admit, apologize, and correct that behavior. However, if the feeling of guilt is more generalized and not specifically relating to any one incident, we need to look closely at who or what made us always feel as though we were wrong or inconveniencing others. Guilt is often an emotion we carry from childhood and then project onto current circumstances when we felt as though we were burdens to those around us. Embarrassment. Embarrassment is what we feel when we know that we did not behave in a way that we are proud of. Other people can never make us feel as embarrassed as we make ourselves feel. When you are truly and completely confident that you are doing the best you can with what you have in front of you, you stop feeling embarrassed all the time. Sure, others can make you feel bad with their comments or ideas, but even their worst judgments tend to be neutralized when we accept ourselves and feel proud of who we are. Shame is the shadow side of embarrassment. This is when the natural, occasional feeling of being embarrassed turns into a way for us to completely condemn ourselves as human beings and begin to see ourselves as worthless and invalid. When we do not process the feeling of embarrassment, it tends to turn into something far darker. Jealousy. Jealousy is a cover-up emotion. It presents as anger or judgment, when in reality it is sadness and self-dissatisfaction. If you want to know what you truly want out of life, look at the people who you are jealous of. No, you may not want exactly what they have, but the feeling that you are experiencing is anger, that they are allowing themselves to pursue it, while you are not. When we use our jealousy to judge other people's accomplishments, we are siding into its shadow function. When we use our jealousy to show us what we would like to accomplish, we begin to recognize the self-sabotaging behavior and get ready to commit to what we actually desire. You can think of it this way. When we see someone who has something we really want, but we are suppressing our willingness to pursue it, we must also condemn it in them so we can justify our own course of action. Instead of this, we can see what we'd also like to create. Resentment. When we resent people, it is often because they did not live up to the expectation of them that we had in our minds. Resentment, in some ways, is like a projected regret. Instead of trying to show us what we should change, it seems to want to tell us what other people should change. However, other people are under no obligation to live up to our ideas of them. In fact, our only problem is that we have an unrealistic expectation that someone was meant to be exactly as we think they should, or love us exactly as we imagined they would. When we are faced with resentment, what we instead must do is reinvent our image of those around us or those we have perceived as having wronged us. Other people are not here to love us perfectly. They are here to teach us lessons, to show us how to love them and ourselves better. When we release the ideas we have about who they should be, we can see them for who they are and the role they are meant to play in our lives. Instead of focusing on how they should change, we can focus instead on what we can learn. Regret. Much like jealousy, regret is also another way that we show ourselves not what we wish we could have done in the past, but what we absolutely need to create going forward. The truth is that most people regret what they did not do more than they ever regret what they did. This isn't a coincidence. Regret isn't actually trying to just make us feel bad that we didn't live up to our own expectations. It is trying to motivate us to live up to them going forward. It is trying to show us what it is absolutely imperative to change in the future and what we really care about experiencing before we die. Didn't travel when you were young? Regret is showing you that you should do it now. Didn't look as nice as you wanted to? Regret is showing you that you should try harder. Made choices that didn't reflect your best self? Regret is showing you that you should make different ones now. Didn't love someone while you had them? Regret is showing you that you should appreciate people now. Chronic fear. When we cannot stop returning to fearful thoughts, it is not always because there is an actual threat in front of us. Often, it is because our internal response systems are underdeveloped or sidelined by trauma. When we are in a state of fearful thinking, it doesn't matter what we are afraid of. The thought process follows us from problem to problem. Often there's a metaphor encoded within it. For example, we may be afraid of an ultimate loss of control or some external force coming in and unraveling our progress. Regardless, chronic fearful thinking often comes back down to feeling the need to focus our energy and attention on a potential threat so we can protect ourselves from it. We imagine that if we are worried, anxious, or angry about it, it will remain within our awareness and therefore cannot surprise us. We can retain some control over it. The very act of holding these fearful thoughts within our minds is exactly how the fear is controlling us in the first place. It is derailing our lives right now because we are channeling our energy into something that is outside of our control, as opposed to using it for everything that is actually within our control. The habits, actions, and behaviors that would actually move our lives forward. In this sense, what we are afraid of is really a projection of what's already happening. The only true way to get over chronic fear is actually to get through it. Instead of trying to battle, resist, and avoid what we cannot control, we can learn to simply shrug and say, "And if that happens, it happens." The second we are able to shrug, laugh, or even just throw our hands up and say, "Whatever, it will be fine," we instantly take back all of our power. What keeps the fire of fear raging is the idea that if we accept what we are afraid of, we are giving in to the worst potential outcome. The truth is that when we stop being afraid of what we cannot control and know instead that nothing can possibly ruin our lives more than we are ruining them with our negative, distracted, and irrational thinking and focus, we are completely freed. When we are in full acceptance, fear leaves our consciousness and becomes a non-issue. It is at this point we realize that it always was. Our internal guidance systems whisper until they scream. The things that are bothering you most right now are not external forces trying to torture you for the sake of it. They are your own mind, identifying what in your life can be fixed, changed, and transformed. If you continue to not take action, the siren will only get louder. And if you never learn to listen to it, you will probably just disassociate from it and then be a victim to it. You already have the answers. You already know what you're here to do. You are here to create everything that would make you happier than you can imagine. It is only a matter of quieting your mind enough so you can feel all of the unlimited potential that is begging you to be used. There's no such thing as self-sabotage, because the behaviors that you think are holding you back are really just meeting your needs. It's not a matter of trying to push yourself beyond them. It's a matter of seeing them for what they are, and then finding better, healthier ways to fulfill them. Though we live in an age where people tend to tell us that we should be entirely self-sufficient and to want or need another person's presence, validation, or company is a sign of self-sufficiency, that is not an accurate portrayal of what it means to be human, and it severely overlooks the reality of human nature and connection. Though many people are codependent and lean far too heavily on others to give them a sense of safety and self, leaning too far the other way, where you believe that you don't need anyone or anything and that you can do everything yourself, is not healthy either. They are two opposite manifestations of the same wounds, which are mistrust and the inability to connect. Your need to feel validated is valid. Your need to feel the presence of another person is valid. Your need to feel wanted is valid. Your need to feel secure is valid. Often the first reason we start neglecting our essential needs is because we think we are weak for having them. We only believe this because when we were young, we did have to rely almost entirely on others to meet our essential needs. Eventually, this fails us, because another person cannot fulfill us entirely, nor are they responsible for it. As we grow up, we learn self-sufficiency. In fact, reliance on oneself for the foundation of our basic needs is an important part of a person's development. In the same way, it is also important that we recognize we cannot meet every single one of our needs on our own. Human beings are hardwired for connection to others and to a group. This is why we exist in subsets like communities and families, and generally feel happiest and most fulfilled when we are doing things that serve the greater good. This is a fundamental and healthy part of who we are, and it is not a sign of weakness. In other cases, your need to feel financially secure is healthy. It is not always a product of you being greedy or ill-intentioned. Your need to be validated for the work that you do is healthy, and it is not always a product of you being vain. Your need to live in a space and area that you enjoy being in is healthy, and it is not always a product of you being ungrateful for what you have. Your subconscious mind is trying to communicate with you. Within our self-sabotaging behaviors lies incredible wisdom. Not only can they tell us how and what we have been traumatized by, they can also show us what we really need. Embedded within each self-sabotaging behavior is actually the key to unlock it, if only we can understand it first. These are a few brief examples of how your subconscious mind might be trying to communicate with you through your behaviors. The way you are self-sabotaging. Going back to the same person who broke you in a relationship. This could be a platonic friend, but is most commonly a former romantic partner. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? It could be time to evaluate your childhood relationships. If you find something comforting or appealing about someone who hurts you, there's usually a reason. The way you are self-sabotaging. Attracting people who are too broken to commit in a real way. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? You are not too broken to find someone who actually wants you. And when you begin to recognize that you are worthy of being committed to, you'll start choosing partners who do just that. The way you are self-sabotaging. Feeling unhappy, even if nothing is wrong, and really, you've gotten everything you've wanted in life. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? You are probably expecting outside things to make you feel good, rather than relying on changing how you think and what you focus on. No outward accomplishment is going to give you a true and lasting sense of inner peace, and your discomfort, despite your accomplishments, is calling your attention to that. The way you are self-sabotaging, pushing people away. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? You want people to love and accept you so much that the stress of it all makes you isolate yourself from the pain, effectively creating the reality you're trying to avoid. Alternatively, needing solitude too often usually means there is a discrepancy between who you pretend to be and who you actually are. When you show up to your life more authentically, it becomes easier to have people around you, as it requires less effort. The way you are self-sabotaging, automatically believing what you think and feel is true. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? You want to worry because it feels comfortable and therefore safer. The more you blindly trust every random thought or feeling that passes through you, the more you are going to be at the whim of what's happening around you. You must learn to steady yourself in clarity, truth, and groundedness, and to be able to mentally discern between what is helpful and what is not. The way you are self-sabotaging, eating poorly when you don't want to. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? You are doing too much, or you're not giving yourself enough rest and nourishment. You are being too extreme. This is why your body is requiring that you continue to fuel it. Alternatively, it could be that you are emotionally hungry. And because you are not giving yourself the true experiences you crave, you are satisfying your hunger another way. The way you are self-sabotaging. Not doing the work you know would help move your career forward. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? You might not be as clear as you think you are on what you want to be doing. If it isn't flowing, there is a reason. Instead of trying to push through and continually hitting the same wall over and over again, take a step back. Maybe it's time to regroup, re-strategize, or seriously think about why you're trying to take the steps you are. Something needs to change, and it's probably not just your motivation. The way you are self-sabotaging. Overworking. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? You do not have to prove your value. You do, however, have to stop running from the discomfort of being alone with your feelings, which is very often the reason that people overwork. There is a difference between being passionately committed to something and feeling obligated to outperform everyone else. One is healthy, the other is not. The way you are self-sabotaging, caring too much about what other people think. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? You are not as happy as you think you are. The happier you are with something, the less you need other people to be. Instead of wondering whether or not someone else will think you are enough, stop and ask yourself, is my life enough for me? How do you really feel about your life when you aren't looking at it through the eyes of others? The way you are self-sabotaging. Spending too much money. What your subconscious mind might want you to know? Things will not make you feel more secure. You will not be able to purchase your way into a new life or identity. If you are overspending or spending outside of your means on a regular basis to the point that it is detrimental to you, you need to look at what function buying or shopping serves. Is it a distraction? A replacement for a hobby? or an addiction to the feeling of being renewed in some way? Determine what your needs really are, and then go from there. The way you are self-sabotaging: dwelling on past relationships or continually checking up on exes. What your subconscious mind might want you to know: this relationship affected you more than you are letting yourself believe. The ending hurt you more than you acknowledged, and you need to process that. Your continued interest in this person means there's something about the relationship that is still unresolved, and it is probably some kind of closure or acceptance that you need to find for yourself. The way you are self-sabotaging: choosing friends who always make you feel like you're in competition with them. What your subconscious mind might want you to know: wanting to feel better than people is not a replacement for needing to feel connected to them, but that's often how we use it. We do this not because we actually want to be superior, but because we want to seem valuable and valued. What we want is authentic connection and to feel important to others. But making them feel inferior is not the way to accomplish it. The way you are self-sabotaging: having self-defeating thoughts that hold you back from doing what you want. What your subconscious mind might want you to know: being mean to yourself first will not make it hurt less if other people judge or reject you, though that is why you are using this defense mechanism. Thinking the worst of yourself is a way of trying to numb yourself to what you really fear, which is that someone else could say those things about you. What you don't realize is that you're acting as your own bully and enemy by doing it to yourself. What could someone else's judgment realistically do to your life? Honestly, it could stop you from pursuing your dreams, ambitions, and personal happiness. And that's exactly what you're doing when you stay fixated on those damaging ideas. It's time to get out of your own way. The way you are self-sabotaging: not promoting your work in a way that would help you move forward. What your subconscious mind might want you to know: you're not creating the best possible work you can, and you sense it. The reason why you're holding back is a fear of judgment, but that wouldn't exist if you weren't already judging yourself. You have to create things you are proud to share. And when sharing them in a positive way that helps grow your business or career feels natural and authentic, you will know that you are doing the work that is at the best of your ability or potential. The way you are self-sabotaging: ascribing intent or worrying that things are about you when they aren't. What your subconscious mind might want you to know: you think about yourself too often. Other people's lives do not revolve around you, nor do their thoughts. They are busy thinking about themselves in the same way that you are thinking about yourself. Remember that patterns in your life are indicative of your own behaviors, but imagining that every time someone cuts you off in traffic is a personal attack, you're going to severely hold yourself back, because you'll always be the victim of something. The way you are self-sabotaging: staying in a city or town you claim to dislike. What your subconscious mind might want you to know: home is where you make it, not where you find it. Is this an issue of you being unable to move, or are you simply unwilling? Usually when we stay in the same place, there's a reason. There's something we love about it, and it's where we want to spend our lives. The resistance comes in because of the judgment we imagine others may think if they know we don't live in the coolest, biggest, or the best area. You may also fear that people will judge you for not having progressed enough. The truth is that you are judging yourself, and you need to make peace or take pride in why you choose to live where you do. The way you are self-sabotaging: mindlessly scrolling through social media as a way to pass the time. What your subconscious mind wants you to know: this is one of the easiest ways to numb yourself because it is so accessible and addictive. There is a world-altering difference between using social media in a healthy way versus as a coping mechanism. Mostly, it has to do with how you feel after you're finished. If you don't put the phone down feeling inspired or relaxed, you're probably trying to avoid some kind of discomfort within yourself. The very discomfort that just might be telling you that you need to change. Learning to listen again. Now that you're starting to pay attention to your internal cues, it is important to understand how to listen to yourself and respond in real time. You are in the situation you are in now because you did not know how to understand or meet your needs in the moment. If you do not want to constantly have to be fixing your choices and behaviors, you have to learn how to process and interpret your feelings in real time. This will be done by a process of building emotional intelligence, which will be primarily done in the next chapter. However, this is where we begin, by understanding how to listen to our instincts. How to follow your gut without getting scared of the future. One of the most essential tenets of modern wisdom is the idea that deep down, you know the truth about everything in your life and, by extension, your future. The idea is that you are an oracle unto yourself, and your feelings are apertures into not only what's happening now, but what's going to happen soon. We're not to blame for believing this. There's a significant amount of research that proves the interconnectedness of our brains and bodies, explaining why, when we have a gut feeling or an instinct that precedes logic, it is often correct. This is because the lining of our gastrointestinal system functions as a second brain, given how it stores a backlog of information that your conscious mind can't recall faster than your body can sense. It is this incredible skill that makes your instinct almost always correct. Your gut, though intelligent, isn't psychic. If you want to tune into yourself more, follow your heart, pursue your passion, find your soul, whatever it is, the first thing that you have to understand is that your gut instinct can only respond to what's happening in the present. If you have an instinct about a future event, you're projecting. This is how you can start breaking down your gut feelings. Are you responding to someone who is in front of you, or are you responding to your idea of them in your head? Are you reacting to a situation that's playing out right now, or are you reacting to one you imagine, assuming you know how it will go? Are your feelings regarding what's happening right now, or what you hope and fear will happen in the future? Aside from only really being able to function in the present, your gut instinct is also quiet. The little voice within is just that, little. It does not scream. It does not panic. It does not pump your body with adrenaline to get your attention. It is not angry. It is the wave of clarity that overcomes you in the middle of your darkest moments, in which something tells you, it's going to be all right. It's not as bad as you think. Everything is okay. Your gut instinct functions to make things better, whereas your imagination can often make things worse. But this is often confusing to people because which feelings are your instincts and what are your fears or doubts or limiting beliefs? How do we know the difference? Well, your instincts aren't actually feelings. They are responses. If you find yourself particularly drained after spending time with someone or are feeling like you don't want to see them again, that's your instinct. If the work that you do exhausts you and every bit of it is forced and undesirable, that is your instinct. Instinct is not a feeling. You don't have an instinct that you're sad today. Instinct is quickly moving yourself out of harm's way without having to think about it. You have to remember that your feelings, while valid, are not often real. They are not always accurate reflections of reality. They are, however, always accurate reflections of our thoughts. Our thoughts change our feelings, Our thoughts do not change our instincts. What you naturally gravitate toward or away from is your instinct. It's not something you feel or interpret, it's something you naturally do. When people talk about using their instincts to craft a life they love, this is what they mean. That they are obeying what their subtle intuition tells them they feel best doing. Sometimes your instinct can move you toward your art, even if it makes you uncomfortable and resistant. Sometimes your instinct can move you to keep working on a relationship, even when it's hard. Your instinct doesn't exist to ensure you feel comfortable and ecstatic at all hours of the day. It moves you toward what you're meant to do because it shows you where your interests, skills, and desires intersect. Instinct and fear can feel similar. To trust your gut is not to treat it as an oracle. This is when the concept becomes so problematic. We are not only believing random feelings blindly, but also applying future meaning to them, assuming that everything we feel is actually warning us or showing us what's ahead. Let's unpack why and how this happens, and how you can prevent it from ruining your life. Feelings do not inform you of the right decision to make. Right decisions create the right feelings. Your feelings are not intended to guide you throughout life. That is what your mind is for. If you were to honestly follow your every impulse, you would be completely stuck, complacent, and possibly dead, or at the very least in severe trouble. You aren't, because your brain is able to intervene and instruct you on how to make choices that reflect what you want to be experiencing long term. You begin experiencing feelings of peace and joy in your life when you condition yourself to take repeated daily actions that facilitate clarity, calmness, healthfulness, and purposefulness, not the other way around. If you want to master your life, you have to learn to organize your feelings. By becoming aware of them, you can trace them back to the thought process that prompted them. And from there, you can decide whether or not the idea is an actual threat or concern, or a fabrication of your reptilian mind just trying to keep you alive. Remember, your brain was built for nature. Your body was designed to survive in the wild. You have an animalistic form trying to navigate a highly civilized modern world. Forgive yourself for having these impulses, and at the same time, understand that your choices are ultimately yours. You can feel something and not act on it. So why are we even told to listen to our instincts in the first place? Your gut is deeply connected to your mind. There's a physiological connection between your gastrointestinal system and serotonin production in your brain. Your vagus nerve runs from your gut to your head, acting as a communication device to help your system regulate. Your stomach and your mind are inherently connected, which is why people allude to just knowing something deep down, or explain that when they're upset, they're sick to their stomach or had a gut reaction to something. What isn't being addressed is the fact that listening to your instinct is something that happens in the present moment. You cannot have an instinct about a future event because it doesn't exist yet. You can have a fear-based or memory response that you are projecting into the future, but you cannot instinctively know something about another person or a future event until it is in front of you. When you have a gut instinct about someone, it is after interacting with them. When you know whether or not a job is right for you, it is only after having done it for a while. The problem is that we are trying to use our instincts as fortune-telling mechanisms, our brain's creative way of trying to manipulate our body to help us avoid pain and increase pleasure in the future. But that's not what happens. We end up stuck because we are literally trusting every single thing that we feel instead of discerning what's an actual reaction and what's a projection. Identifying the difference between instinct and fear. First and foremost, understand that your instinct can serve you immensely in the present moment. Your first reaction to something is very often the wisest reaction, because your body is using all of the subconscious information you have logged away to inform you about something before your brain has an opportunity to second-guess it. You can use this to your advantage by staying in the moment and asking yourself what is true right here and right now. What is true when you are with another person, activity, or behavior? What is the deep gut instinct that you get when you're presently engaging with something? Does it differ from what you think and feel about it when you are just imagining it, making guesses about it, recalling details of it, or imagining what it will be like? Typically, those projections are fear, and your present reaction is your honest instinct. Overall, your honest gut instinct won't ever frighten you into panic. Your gut is always subtle and gentle, even if it's telling you that something isn't for you. If your gut wants you to know not to see someone or to stop engaging in a relationship or behavior, the impulse will be quiet. That's why it's called the little voice within. So easy to miss. So easy to shout over. Intuitive nudges versus intrusive thoughts. When you start listening to yourself, you might find it hard to tell the difference between thoughts that are helpful and intuitive and thoughts that are damaging and intrusive. They both function similarly. They are immediate, reactive, and offer some kind of previously unseen insight. And yet, they function so completely differently in practice. This is how to start telling the difference between thoughts that are informed by your intuition and thoughts that are informed by fear. Intuitive thoughts are calm. Intruding thoughts are hectic and fear-inducing. Intuitive thoughts are rational. They make a degree of sense. Intruding thoughts are irrational and often stem from aggrandizing a situation or jumping to the worst conclusion possible. Intuitive thoughts help you in the present. They give you information that you need to make a better informed decision. Intruding thoughts are often random and have nothing to do with what's going on in the moment. Intuitive thoughts are quiet. Intruding thoughts are loud, which makes one harder to hear than the other. Intuitive thoughts usually come to you once, maybe twice, and they induce a feeling of understanding. Intruding thoughts tend to be persistent and induce a feeling of panic. Intuitive thoughts often sound loving, while invasive thoughts sound scared. Intuitive thoughts usually come out of nowhere. Invasive thoughts are usually triggered by external stimuli. Intuitive thoughts don't need to be grappled with. You have them, and then you let them go. Invasive thoughts begin a whole spiral of ideas and fears, making it feel impossible to stop thinking about them. Even when an intuitive thought doesn't tell you something you like, it never makes you feel panicked. Even if you experience sadness or disappointment, you don't feel overwhelmingly anxious. Panic is the emotion you experience when you don't know what to do with a feeling. It is what happens when you have an invasive thought. Intuitive thoughts open your mind to other possibilities. Invasive thoughts close your